This podcast is offered by Wildflowers and Sangha. A Dharma talk by Roshi Amy to SLA Hollowell.
Good evening, everyone. Cats, too. I don't know how many there are, but I know there's at least one, two, three, four. I think Isabel has one too, right? Five. I don't have one yet. Wish I did, but I don't. But I do observe the cats in my out in my back garden. The way that my garden is placed, it's a passage. It's kind of the cat passage. The neighborhood cats pass through there. All of the gardens are enclosed, so they can go from garden to garden, and they don't go in the street. And they find ways to climb on roofs and on walls. And we left a little space in the wall between our house and Donna next door so that the cats can go. When I had a cat, we did that. And I was watching them today, and it occurred to me that they have a completely different experience of space than what I have, or that the neighbors have. I don't think they really have. I've heard that cats have, it's kind of like a timeshare territory business they have, where they're aware that certain cats and animals are in the territory at certain times, and then at other times they're not. And so they kind of share the territory. Of course, this is not what humans do, right? I very much think of it as my garden and the neighbor's garden. And the garage next door. The back wall of the building that gives onto my garden, which is not mine. And the cats, I don't really think they think of it that way. Of course, they know where their house is. They know where the food is. I think they might, you know, try to explore and see if they can get food somewhere else too. I don't know if they do, and I don't know if my cat ever was fed anywhere else. You know, she would disappear for hours, and I have no idea where she went. I don't give the other cats food. If I'm outside, I talk to them. You know, if I'm inside, I just observe and marvel at their. Try to imagine what their experience of the territory is. And then, of course, the birds, same thing. The birds have a very different experience of the space than the cats or I do. The birds, I watch them and they take off, and within 15 seconds, they're like a block and a half away or something. Having flown over the houses and disappeared. They can be in the very top of the tree. They can be like on the top of the apartment building next door, seeing completely differently. They can probably see into the shrubs and the bushes and the grass, things that I have no idea exist there. And this is really enlightening to think that that's just two, three species, right? Human, cat, and bird. And yet experiencing this same space in a very different way. And yet we share the space. Of course, the humans are more territorial, and you know, this is my space, whereas the birds and the cats probably don't think that way. And then what about the space inside? So I have this experience of this space inside, which is very different from your experience of your space inside. And my experience of you is not at all what your experience is of yourself. And your experience of me is not at all my experience of myself. And yet we're breathing the same air. The sun is shining on each of us, all of us. The rain is falling. Today, rained in Paris. It's snowing in other places. The United States is 75% of the territory of the United States is covered in snow at this moment, which is quite extraordinary. We had snow here when I think it was last week, 10 days ago maybe. In Portugal, I have no idea what kind of weather you have there. Probably warmer than here. Probably no snow. Maybe rain. Probably lots of sun too. You know, the sun's warmer, I'm sure. And yet, it's the same sun. It's the same earth. It's the same sky. It's the same air. And yet we're each experiencing it differently. Depending on our circumstances, depending on where we're standing. Someone standing in my house looking at my garden doesn't experience the cats in the same way that I do if they're standing in an apartment next door looking down on the garden. And yet, same sun, same land, same earth, same air, same home. We're all sharing the same home, which is the earth. Today, when I went to put on, tonight, when I went to get a rakusu to put on, I picked one up that I haven't worn for a while. I decided to try doing that, changing rakusus instead of always wearing the same one, because I do have the choice. The rest of you don't have the choice. Those of you who have rakusus, except Joe, he has a choice. He has two. He could wear his other one. And I picked this one that's silver, and which my teacher gave me in 2008. On my birthday, and she wrote on it, you've heard me say this quote many times, when I look inside and see that I'm nothing, that's wisdom. When I look outside and see that I am everything, that's love. Between these two, my life turns. And this is a quote from Nisargatta. I don't know what book it comes from, but it's quite a famous quote, and I talk about it a lot. You've heard me from time to time. So this is telling us to look inside. That's where he starts, right? When I look inside and see that I'm nothing, that's wisdom. Immediately we think, nothing? Nothing? What does that mean, nothing? I'm nothing? I'm worthless? I'm nobody? I'm not important? This is not what it means. It doesn't mean that that everyone else is more important and everyone else is something and I'm nothing. It's more like not a thing. When I look inside and see that I am not a thing, I'm no thing. In English, it works well, the words. I don't know about French, Portuguese, German, Flemish. I don't know how it works, but the word nothing. Rien. Nada, I suppose, in Portuguese, or what is it? Yeah, nada. These are all really expressive words, but usually when we use them, there's something about an absence that we're referring to. And he, in his quote, Nisargatha, is not, it's not about absence. It's about not, we see that we are not what we think we are. We see that we are not the thing that we think we are. We're not an object. We're not even the subject we think that we are. There is nothing substantial about us. In the same way that I look out and I see how the cats are seeing things otherwise, or birds. There is no fixed perspective. There is no fixed, the sky is not fixed. The sky is a really good example, because the sky, we can't even grasp it. We have no possibility of seeing the end of it. Or seeing it at all, actually. We know, you know, that if we go up in an airplane, it's not like we touch the sky. It's not like we come to the walls of the sky. We may climb above the clouds, but the sky is still there. And that's what we talk about when we say, I look inside and see that I'm nothing. It's like I look inside and I see that I'm the sky. I'm that big. I'm that empty. I'm that complete. You know, I'm that whole, let's say. There's nothing missing in the sky when we look up there. That concept of something missing in the sky, it doesn't even really work, right? We can't think of something missing in the sky. Sometimes there are clouds, sometimes there aren't. Sometimes there are stars, sometimes there aren't. But that's not the sky. So our nature is the nature of the sky. It's nothing, we say. We don't have a fixed identity. We're not limited like we think we are. And we see that there's no beginning and end. We call this wisdom, to see the absolute wholeness, the absolute oneness, the absolute perfection of this, which is nothing in that sense. And then he says, when I look outside and see that I am everything, that's love or compassion, we could say. Because in Zen, we talk about wisdom and compassion. Compassion being the functioning of wisdom. So when we awaken to this, I am nothing, and we look outside and we see I am everything, the automatic functioning is compassion, love. It's all me. It's all you. Every single manifestation, the birds, the grass, the snow, the rain, every cat, every hair on the cat, the little tulips that are just starting to sprout in my garden, all of it. Each is a perfect manifestation of this oneness. And yet it's singular. Absolutely singular manifestation of it. And we see that when we see this, we see that it's all connected. You know, if I could have that bird's eye view, I would see that the gardens are not actually separated. We put up walls, but it's all one, actually. And even the street, you know, my front door, I go into the street, it's just a door that I built there. I didn't build it, but a door that is there that creates the inside and the outside, but it's really all one. It's all interconnected, all these phenomena, you know, all connected. And we see the damage that we do when we don't respect that. We see that in what's happening with the environment. We see that happening with wildlife. You know, there are species that are being eliminated, insects that are being eliminated, human beings that are being eliminated. When we don't see that all of us, no matter what our nationality is, what the color of our skin is, no matter what language we speak, no matter if we're old or young, man, woman, trans, however we identify sexually, whatever our intellect is, whatever our job is, we're all one. We're all interconnected. And when we awaken to that reality, wisdom, when we see that we are not limited and fixed, then we see the connection, the interconnection. And when we awaken to that, then we respond to the world with what we call loving action. We act to improve the well-being of ourselves, of others, of our community, of our family, of people we don't know, and the planet, the well-being of the planet. We don't know what that action is. Some people will, you know, become involved in politics. Some people will become, will take care of their neighbors. Some people take care of their children. Some people write books. Some people build houses. It's infinite the number of ways that we can engage with the world with loving action. It's every moment there's a possibility. Now, at the same time, it's not like we arrive at some point where we've seen it and then we don't have to do it anymore. We don't have to practice anymore. That awakening, that wisdom is also not fixed. And so to live our engaged life, it requires that we cultivate our inner life and our awakening and expand and enrich our practice to continue this process of awakening to the oneness of life so that we can respond to the world with loving action. respond to ourselves with loving action as well. And that's what he says when he says, between these two, my life turns. It's not fixed on one nothing or everything. They're not even two, actually, but the way that he formulated it, it's two. I look inside, I'm nothing, that's wisdom. Look outside, I'm everything, that's compassion. But if we, it's like two legs, you know, we have to walk on the two legs. So, you know, what does that mean for us? It means I guess maybe something like discovering something bigger than yourself, we have a hunger for that, right? To something bigger than ourselves, or some kind of meaning. Sometimes it might take that form, but this. I am nothing and I am everything. That's something that is bigger than just me. And it allows us to, our Zen practice allows us to discover that. And it brings us to that well, maybe, you know, that practice that I give sometimes of saying yes to everything, whatever arises, that's a practice of opening to something bigger than me. That's a practice of seeing that I am nothing and I am everything. Because if I'm stuck on some, I am something, then I can't open to whatever else arises. I can't really open it. So if I can drop that and say yes instead of no, that allows me to widen, to expand, and open to this sky. There's this expression in English, the sky is the limit, which means there is no limit. When we say that expression, that's what that means. There is no limit. And you are that sky as well. And when we say yes, that allows us to, it's frightening sometimes, but it gives us a path to experience this, the fluidity of life. The amazing fluidity and interconnection and space that there is, the wholeness of it all. That's when we aren't focusing on something bigger than ourselves, that escapes us because our minds are grasping for something little. Something limited, something to hold. And so we get lost, we don't have access to that fluidity of life. There's an American poet who's also a Zen practitioner, Jane Hirschfeld, who says, poetry gives her access, or poetry instructs her how to live a 360-degree life. So 360 degrees, as we know, is like that's the whole panorama. That's everything. And because she's a poet, that's how she sees poetry. But we could replace the word poetry for Zen, and I think she probably would agree with that. It has the same quality of asking us to not be fixed somewhere. The poetry, we can't get our mind around it. We can't understand it. It expresses an experience of the world that is larger, that escapes us usually, and that's the same with our practice. The mystery. We awaken to the mystery of it. And like I say in one of my own poems, the mystery is not cleared up, but the mystery now is clear. It's clear that there's the mystery. It doesn't take the mystery away, our practice. It's the opposite. It introduces us deeper and deeper and deeper to the mystery. And the beauty of that. So this is all kind of, sounds maybe kind of esoteric or mystical, but you know, it's not actually, it's really every moment. Everything I'm telling you came to mind for me when I was watching cats this morning. The mystery of the cat view. And the mystery of the bird view. Mystery of my view. Because I realize how limited it is. And so, can I expand it? Expand it by introducing the other views. And viewing the cats other than how I usually see them. Seeing my own garden differently than I usually see it. Seeing my own desk, my own room, you know, my own office. You know, I come in here and I see those flowers every morning. It's not always the same flowers, but, and I think, what are they doing today? You know, what's happening with those flowers today? And it's a great mystery what's happening to those flowers. So that's what came to mind today when I was watching the cats, and when I saw at least one of your cats appear in the screen, but I know the others are there. So actually, Louisa maybe has cats too, no? No? You don't have cats anymore, Louisa? Oh, no, okay. Anyway, so please let me know what you're thinking or want to say or questioning, anything. There was also a dog. I forgot the dog. There was also a dog present. Christine's. I didn't see Carla's tonight, but I saw Christine's. Joao.
Good evening, Roshi. Good evening, everyone. Three lines from a poem came to mind as you were speaking. let me try and put it in English. I am nothing. I will always be nothing. Actually, it's four lines. So I'm nothing. I will always be nothing. I cannot want, I may not want to be something. I'm notwithstanding, I have in me all the dreams of the world.
Can you say in Portuguese?
Yes. Não sou nada, nunca serei nada, não posso querer ser nada. A parte disso, tenho em mim todos os sonhos do mundo. And then the poem goes on. So I felt like sharing these.
Who is the poet?
Fernando Pessoa.
I knew it. I thought it might have been Cairo.
No, it's Álvaro de Campos.
Ah.
Yeah, actually it's Álvaro de Campos. These are fairly famous lines, but people don't usually, who know them, don't pay attention to them. But anyway, and then there's, I'm not going into that, because in Portuguese you cannot put it in English, but because it's kind of dual. You can read it both ways. When he says, não sou nada, it's kind of a double negative. At the same time, you can read it as, I am nothing. But you can also read it, I am something. Or I am, so you can actually, I'm nothing. You can read it at the same time, like he's saying, I am nothing, but you can also read it as, I am not nothing, so I'm something. So you can, anyway, not relevant now.
Joel?
Yes, could you clarify how you put together this notion of this experience of mystery with something that we hear a lot, which is, you know, seeing reality as it is, and also that reminds me also how it connects to maybe more towards the mystery, but the second vow about the illusions are inexhaustible. So how all that fit together?
The mystery, when we see things as they are, we see the mystery. The because nothing is what we thought it was. It's not, we say the famous thing from Dogen of mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. And then we have an experience of when we manage to let go of our ideas about them, to just put it simply, mountains are not mountains and rivers are not rivers. They're not what we thought they were. And then when we, maybe the space where my life turns, mountains are mountains and rivers, but they're not what they were before. They're not what I think. And we can't say what they are. We can only experience it. The mystery of the water running in the river. The mystery of the sky, the mystery of the village, the bell ringing. Who was it? I saw somebody today on Skype, and just as we connected, the bell was ringing in the church behind them. I guess no one here online. But the mystery of all that, the mystery of creation, the mystery of all things, you know, it's unfathomable how there could be, how this endless, infinite interconnection and how it all works so perfectly together. It's mysterious. In the sense of not knowing, mysterious. How does that work then with the second vow? Is that you said with the delusions?
Yeah, delusions are inexhaustible. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, maybe it's, you know, the mystery is inexhaustible. I vow to see it. It doesn't mean that there's an end to it, but it means that I clarify it, that I see the mystery, I see the delusions. And that's putting an end to the delusion of thinking there's an end to delusion or something like that. As long as we're, like I often say, if you are completely one with delusion, there's no delusion. It's the separation we create and the limits we put that make it that way. So if we can truly, truly see that delusions are inexhaustible and live that, then we put an end to them. And yet, we vow it again and again and again because we have to do it again and again and again. It's endless. Something like that. I'm just responding to the question about the delusions tied with the mystery. I hadn't thought of this in that term, those terms before, but that's what comes to mind.
Yeah, so what is striking, what you said is not to understand the seeing things as they are, seeing reality or seeing ultimate, sometimes we talk even about ultimate truth, is really an opening up to, instead of thinking, oh, it's something fixed, it's actually the exact contrary. It might look like it's something finite, but it plunges us into the vast, boundless sea of unknown and the mystery of life. Right?
Yeah, something like that.
And therefore, it's inexhaustible. Like these delusions are inexhaustible. So we actually see that it's not something fixed, and it's not something that I can grasp. But it's like an opening up to the unfathomable reality, a boundless, mysterious, endless. And
yeah, absolutely. And it, you know, it's because you mentioned this, I have just happened to have this book of mine right here, and there's this poem in it, very short and simple, okay? So I'm not going to impose any kind of weird poetry on you. I saw an apple when I finally stopped to sit and look. I saw that when I didn't see the apple was not an apple. I didn't see the apple was an apple. I saw that when I saw the apple was an apple. I saw that the apple was not an apple. I saw that when I saw that the apple was an apple and not an apple, I saw that the apple was all there was to see. So this is a lot of kind of, you know, coming and going and playing with language, kind of like so with not and whatever. But thing is, you know, we don't really look at an apple or a pen or glass, whatever. We don't really look at it. But when we finally stop and look at it, we realize if we really look into it, and this comes to what you're saying, Joe, kind of, I realized that when I didn't see the apple was not an apple, because I was so attached to the apple being an apple, my concept of an apple, right? My experience of past apples. I didn't really see the apple. I didn't see that an apple is an apple. And when I then see that the apple is an apple, I see that the apple's not an apple. It's not what I think it is. It's not the apple I think it is. And I see that when I saw the apple was an apple and not an apple, both, I saw that the apple was all there was to see. There was never anything else to see. And we can say the same thing about anything, you know. Now, I've forgotten what Joe's words were, but for me, that's what came to mind when he said whatever he said. I don't know if you remember what you said, Joe, but... No? Yeah, doesn't matter. It's on the, it's recorded. So we can go back.
A general idea, but I don't remember wording it.
It's recorded, and just a kind of aside, there is a new project that has been launched by João to transcribe the talks, all of the talks from the past year. That's the beginning. Maybe we will go beyond that. Because Joanna found us this software that you just turn on the talk and the software transcribes. So if anyone is interested in helping, I think he's opening that up for, if anyone wants to help, you can contact him. I mean, you have maybe already reached out to some people, I don't know.
Yeah, if you, I sent an email to a number of people, but if you didn't get it, and if you are interested, just contact me, yes.
So it's all of my talks and Joa's talks for the past year, since January 2020.
Wow. I'm sorry to steal time from everybody else, but again, you know what you said, when you are delusional, because Joe mentioned the second vow, when I am fully deluded, there is no delusion. The same thing with the verses with the apple. I had this experience today where something, I was really upset about something. And what I realized was I was so conscious about being upset as I don't remember ever being. You know, it was a different experience. I've been upset before, for sure, but and how it came to me, if I had to put in words the experience, is I was fully upset. And it doesn't go away. It's not about going away and you know, or saying it doesn't matter, or I should just get over it or something. It's not that at all. You experience it fully. I don't know. It came to me. This but there was this experience of being fully upset, you know, I was really I was all there, I was all it, you know. At the same time, I was also conscious of being upset in a way, also in a way I don't, it's like I've never was upset like this, like so fully. Yeah. And that changed something. It's different. It's some way it's different somehow.
Yeah, you know, sometimes people say, oh, Zen practice, you become dead. You don't feel anything anymore. You're supposed to be almost stoic. It's actually the opposite. We feel everything more, like you say. You know, it can be joy, it can be being upset, it can be anger, fear, whatever. But the more we open our hearts, the more space there is, and then of course the more we feel things more deeply, more fully, like you say. Yeah. Christine.
Yeah, it reminds me of the story you told me once about your son who had some party in your house while you were absent. And there was a retreat next door. And you told me that you were very upset. And I really liked hearing that because I thought, okay, she's a Zen teacher. Her son has grown up in this Zen style, you know, lifestyle. And these things happen. He's having a wild party with loud music and people coming to his home who he doesn't really know. And the computer being stolen and Amy being really angry. So my life is kind of normal. Okay.
Well, I don't wish that on you, actually.
No, but it just, you know, it was good to hear that.
Well, I'm glad. It was not a great experience for me.
I guess so.
I was in Portugal on retreat in Coimbra.
Yeah.
And I get this, I see him on my phone, Geno Roshi is calling me. She also was on retreat, and I'm thinking, uh-oh. She knows I'm here in Portugal. She's in the middle of a retreat, and she's calling me. Something's not right. And so she said, you have to do something. We can't do this again. We didn't sleep last night. Can't, and it's starting up again. We can't do. I had no idea. You know, I'd spoken with him and he lied to me directly. But anyway, yes, we are human, and that's how it is. Yeah, it's a beautiful. It's a wonderful life. Even when your kids do stupid stuff like that, you know.
And another thing came to my mind when you talked about the 360 degree view. I recently heard a conference that was really interesting about the polyvagal theory. Has anybody heard about that? It's about the nervous system. And I was familiar with two of these branches that we have. So one is the system that we call the calm and connection system. When everything is fine, you're feeling well and you're trusting and you're happy. Then the nervous system is in a quiet state and it's what we call where you produce hormones that make you feel well and everything like that. And the other way, then there are apparently another two branches. I only knew one other one, which is the attack when something happens that you that makes you feel threatened, then you want to attack or defeat yourself. And the interesting thing that this guy said was that the angle that we can see, if we have a tight angle, that makes us feel threatened. You know, we don't have a full. Anyway, there are animals that can see more of an angle than we do. I think horses can look right, maybe almost at 360, and some insects too with these huge eyes that they have. And in this conference, he did an exercise with us. He made us check how far we can look. And then with a simple, you can, if you want to try, you can look everyone and notice how far you can look. And then just cross your arms like that behind the head and look to one side until you realize that you want to sigh or a breath a little bit deeper, or just wait for some 30 seconds or so. And then look at the other side as far as you can. And when you think you've done, after a few seconds, you release. And we all realized if we look again back, we can turn further away, further behind us. Did it work for you? Mm-hmm. Right, huh? Mm-hmm. And that, just that calms the nervous system, because you have a more flexibility and you feel less threatened when you can see more. Funny.
Yeah, thank you. Part of the reason why we do feel threatened is because we do have this limited, if we extend this beyond your exercise, but it's true.
Yeah, and it made me think of that, really, this whole part of the nervous system, it really relies to what you're talking about. The calm and connection system is, we are one with everything, we feel one with everything, and when we feel threatened, we get out of this state of being one with everything, and we think we have to attack or get into defense mechanisms.
Okay, well, time is up. Thank you. We'll do the vows. And I remind you, next Thursday night, my Dharma brother Roshi Frank Deval will be giving the talk. And the title of the talk is A Zen View of the Mystic Lamb. The Mystic Lamb is, Frank is an artist and a tour guide sometimes, but he's an artist. And he's talking about, in Ghent where he lives, there is this famous altarpiece in the cathedral painted by Van Eyck, which is historic and has been recently restored and was displayed for the first time last year at this time, and then the pandemic came and it had to close down. But anyway, he's going to give us his Zen perspective on this. And he will have pictures. He won't just sit and talk. So And he's a really enchanting speaker about art. So.
And he's obsessed with this painting, so he's really interesting on this painting.